first, when we came on air this time last week, we were just starting to digest the Trump administration's new national security strategy. And it was quite the read. America first, writ large. And perhaps the biggest ideological shift, on paper at least, in US foreign policy since World War II. The White House warned that European nations face the specter of civilizational erasure because of immigration from Muslim countries, and back what it called patriotic anti-immigration parties, a reference to far and hard-right groups such as the AfD in Germany. Just before coming on air, I spoke to Constance Stelzenmüller, who's the director of the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution in Washington. A week on, I asked for her thoughts on the new strategy.
Oh, God, I would have to tell you, and I, as an Australian, I would expect you to sympathise, that some of my thoughts are not fit for a family radio station. But in all seriousness, it's been quite a week, not just because the national security strategy dropped in a sort of weirdly sort of quiet way at 10:30 at night last Thursday, but because it was followed up by a speech by the Secretary of Defense, or I suppose we must now call him Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth. And then there were reports of a not-so-secret codicil with additional disturbing information, and then there was an interview with the president. And so there's been an awful lot on top of this to confirm, not just confirm, but deepen, right, the message of the national security strategy. And I went to a conference on Wednesday that had a lot of Europeans there and some former senior officials, some new senior officials. And yes, I think it's fair to say the shell shock is considerable.
You spoke there of the interview that Donald Trump gave with Politico this week. He really did double down, didn't he? He claimed that Europe was decaying and that its leaders were weak. I mean, those aren't just the sort of comments that spoil your breakfast. They spoil lunch and dinner as well. Give us a sense of how some of the European leaders have responded. Give us a sense of how the German Chancellor, for example, Friedrich Merz, has responded.
Well, I have had no problem with my appetite personally, but the European leaders, I think, have been clear but circumspect. In other words, they have not tried to burn any bridges, but they've also made it very clear that they find this language inappropriate. And honestly, it is. That said, it's not all that surprising. If you live in this country, as I do, I've been living here for the past decade, and if you have been following the thinking of the hard right, as I sadly have also done, then you know that there is a very widespread view that Europe is somehow in decline. Rather bizarrely, and it's been pointed out by a lot of commentators, that the reason that the strategy lists, which is demographics, immigration, regulation, some of those are worse in America. Certainly, America is due to reach the point where it will no longer be a majority white country, whatever that means these days, much earlier than Europe. And so there is a fair amount of projection in this document.
I wonder how the far right and hard right parties in Europe have responded. This sort of support that they are now getting from the Trump administration. I mean, even before this, the AfD in Germany was leading in the polls. Are they doing cartwheels under the Brandenburg Gate?
The European right is actually divided over this. The French hard right, led by Marine Le Pen and Jordan Bardella, are actually very careful because they know that the Trump administration is not popular in America, including among their own base. The AfD is in fact divided, and it's got a leadership fight, in fact, between its eastern base, which is much more oriented towards Russia and very skeptical about supporting Ukraine, and one of the co-leaders of the AfD, Alice Weidel, who thinks that the future of the AfD lies with America. Now, yes, there are about two dozen members of the AfD, members of parliament of the AfD, in town here at the end of this week and going on to New York City for a quote-unquote Young Republican Gala on the weekend, but that frankly, they are backbenchers. None of these are particularly interesting or important, with perhaps one exception, Markus Frohnmayr, who, though interestingly, is one of the AfD members who has been most notably pro-Russian and who has increasingly actually annoyed his own party leadership by going to Moscow so often. So go figure, as they say here.
This strategy is so Kremlin-friendly. In fact, a spokesman for Vladimir Putin said it aligned with Moscow's thinking. Has that created the sense in Europe that it's being abandoned by the United States, that the guarantor of its post-war security?
Abandonment, I wouldn't say. Look, about half of America, a little more than half, obviously, voted for Donald Trump. The other half didn't. You know, this is the season of Christmas parties in Washington, D.C. And if you go to those aren't just an occasion to, you know, have nice Christmas food and drinks, but also sort of run into people and check out how they're doing and how they're feeling about the current moment. And I can tell you that there are a lot of appalled conservatives in this town. I would also point out something more important, which is that both the Supreme Court and the Congress and Senate appear to be gearing up to muster something of a fight, which certainly hasn't been the case for the past 11 months. So I think there are more tensions here, both within the administration's base and or between the what is called the MAGA movement that Trump spearheads and more old-fashioned conservatives.
This national security strategy and the very sort of strong language that the Trump administration has used to criticize Europe puts a lot of strain on the transatlantic alliance. Is there a danger of a permanent rupture?
Well, we thought, I think, in early fall that we had achieved a sort of quasi equilibrium where we had bought time, gotten the Americans to sell us weapons to give to Ukraine, which in turn would buy us time to develop our own deterrence and defense, and that we would continue to receive from them strategic enablers and the protection of the nuclear deterrent. I think the general assessment in Europe is that this timeline, where we thought we might have until the end of the decade, has now become drastically shorter. The challenge has expanded. We're going to have to think about nuclear weapons at some point, although I think that is really the most difficult of them all. And we will certainly have to think about building our own strategic enablers, such as satellite-based information systems and weapons with long-range strike and targeting capability. And that is, I think, a huge thing for European governments to swallow. And I think they're still understandably in the process of digesting that. And one of the, I think, the key touchstones right now between the administration and the Europeans is next week's European summit, at which Europeans hope to get the Belgians to agree to let them collateralize the Russian sovereign assets, which mostly are based in Belgium, to the tune of 210 billion euros. And right now, it appears that the Trump administration would prefer to come to an agreement with the Kremlin to use that same money for joint business investments. So next week looks as though it might be quite exciting. Mm-hmm.
Constance Stelzer-Müller of the Brookings Institution in Washington, thank you so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
You're very welcome.
At the start of that interview, Constance conferred Australian citizenship on me, which was very generous but slightly premature. But that, I hope, will happen in 2026, if you'll have me.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.